Welcome to Professionally Speaking on ThatChannel.com. I am Randall Craig, your host, and today we are joined by Richard Peterson. Richard is a certified sales professional and specializes in coaching individuals to becoming more powerful presenters. Over his career, he has made more than 8,000 presentations and is a contributing author to the book Sales Gurus Speak Out. Richard, welcome to Professionally Speaking TV.
Randall, good morning.
Now, I'm astounded by this 8,000 number.
Mm-hmm.
Over a 25-year career, this means that you have to do 320 presentations every year. And that, in my view, means that there's very little time for vacations, let alone anything else. Is that it? How do people do 8,000 presentations?
8,000 is something I actually have stopped keeping track of. I spent 25 years in the corporate world, and as it turns out, I had one of these quirky habits of keeping track of how many presentations I delivered each day. At one point in my career, we were probably doing 8 to 10 to 12 presentations a day.
Holy cow.
So, you know, I mean, you go by week, by month, by year, yeah, it adds up in a hurry. So I kept track. And it's just this is a big number, and I love using that number.
Yeah, and you know, Sam, Malcolm Gladwell says, you know, 10,000 hours, you've got to spend a lot of time doing something before you really become expert at it. But I'm intrigued because you started your career very early as a freelance commercial photographer, and then you went into sales. How did you make that move?
It really wasn't that much of a leap because it was, I mean, I was always interested in the visual of photography or picture taking that actually was communication or just influence and, you know, art and all that stuff. And the selling was the same thing, where you were using props or materials and showing pictures and all of those kinds of things. And it just kind of happened in that case.
What were you selling? You're in the corporate world selling.
Right. I worked for one of the world's largest photographic manufacturers, and it was primarily consumer products. It was film, cameras. And then from that point, we had moved on to heavier equipment, photo finishing equipment. It became very, very complex at that point.
Okay, so it's really your technical knowledge.
Very technical. Very technical, yeah.
Okay, and then eventually...
And, you know, my goal was to be able to make the technical fun, so that the technical would remain in a person's mind. And that's how the whole presentation of information really got rolling with me.
Now, you spent a lot of years there. Why did you move into the world of presentations, coaching, and sales and training? I mean, that was also another switch.
A couple of reasons. During a lot of the presentations, I got involved also in product launches, influencing individuals to purchase our products, use our products. And very quickly, it came to my mind that some of our presentations aren't that great. So I got involved in, you know, I did a lot of research. Back then, you had to go to the library versus now I can just Google things. How do I do this better? How do I do this better? How do I do this better? And I started to add things to presentations. And often I was criticized because I was kind of trying things that were different. But that was really the influence, that it was my observation that there were so many presentations going on in the consumer world or the manufacturer world that just weren't that great. And no one really cared about it. They just took it for granted. I said, well, let's take it up a notch.
Now, I remember the earliest presentations I did in my career. There was no such thing as video projectors or PowerPoint
even.
And then all of a sudden there was PowerPoint, we had slides manufactured for the presentations. Then we got rid of the slide carousels and we did PowerPoint. This is quite an evolution. What's next?
I think we're going to start to simplify things, that you'll see probably less emphasis on some of the visuals than there have been, because the visuals have really become more of a script for presenters. When you look at PowerPoint, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of visual mediums like PowerPoint, they take a bad rap. It's just software. The issue is there seems to be a gap in the marketplace that many individuals really haven't had any training or coaching. Now, how do you use a visual medium to add to your presentation? Versus the visual medium isn't your presentation. The presentation...
is your presentation.
Is you.
Yes.
All those other things are accessories that are enhancements, or jewelry, as I like to call it in that case, you know, to make it better.
Interesting. PowerPoint as a prop, it's almost full circle to where we started. Yes. 20, 30 years ago, isn't it?
Well, if... all right, turn back the clock and think of what was the very earliest form of visual support. Very earliest, go way back, as far as you can remember.
Oh, I'm thinking about the great Greek speakers who stood at the very bottom.
Farther back.
Oh, gee, something about Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden.
Cave drawings.
Okay, cave drawings.
And cave drawings were very simple. Cave drawings, it's not like a cave drawing. It's not like I would go into the cave and the cave was filled from ceiling to floor to side with symbols and all of these things. It was very simple.
Just the essential message?
Just the essential message. And then it became more complex. And then if we look at normal teaching methods conventional teaching message of a blackboard or a whiteboard, it's not like you have board after board after board after board. Simple phrases, simple catchphrases. PowerPoint has just sort of exploded from the lack of self-awareness from a lot of individuals on how I should really use it as a visual aid. So I think we're coming back. Some corporations or some organizations have actually banned PowerPoint in meetings and presentations. And I become a little uncomfortable with that because, are you battling the symptom? It's really not the software issue. It's what the issue is. Maybe we need to recognize the gap that there are individuals that are talented, good communicators, and they're letting some of the visual now get in the way of their own powerful communication. Mm-hmm. And I see it a lot in my own private practice, how PowerPoint or visuals will suppress or hold back the presenter in terms of getting the message across, because then they're following a set of words or whatever versus their conversational tone.
Okay. So that's interesting because a lot of times people just put their entire presentation on the PowerPoint itself, and that's clearly not what you would recommend.
No, very much so, because PowerPoint is the... If I'm developing a presentation, the first thing I have to do is I have to identify clearly what is the single main point I need to deliver. Once I have that clear, then I can develop my presentation. And then at the very end, I'll decide what is my environment going to be. Is it going to be a large group? Will it be one-on-one? Then I can determine, will PowerPoint or a visual aid enhance that? Versus too many presenters, and I see this regularly in the, certainly the workplace, presenters immediately go to their hard drives on the laptops and say, okay, what do I have in the laptop? What are previous presentations I have? Okay, a few of these slides. There, boom, I have a presentation. Basically, all they've done is they've created a patchwork quilt of information that may not have a specific clear point to an audience or a viewer or a listener in that case. And it becomes just, what I call a very high-density form of communication that makes it more difficult for me as a listener or me as a viewer to say, okay, what is it that they're really trying to say? Oh, so how is it that now it's my job to figure out what that presenter needs to say? It should be the other way around. I think it's in reverse.
Well, very good points. Now, you weren't always an expert in this, and I want you to take us back to some of your very first presentations and tell me what were some of your challenges back then. Where did you get your bruises?
Many bruises. I probably still have some of them. Working for a large photographic company, we certainly produced film, which meant 35-millimeter slides. Now, I'm really going to date myself, in a carousel projector. And the issue we had is we had long lead times. We had to develop what our presentation was. We had all these words. We had to send it in, and somehow all these slides came back,
mm-hmm.
complete with typos, with whatever it happened to be, and we didn't see them till literally 24 hours before we had to present. So we would literally... be unrehearsed at that point. We would walk up and we would be as surprised at each slide as it popped up as the audience was. And that's how we fumbled through it. And that was a real challenge in that case.
Was that your biggest challenge when you started?
The biggest challenge was having support from, let's say our presentation teams, if we went on product launch, having support from something that I've become an absolute tyrant on, when I work with participants in terms of the power of rehearsal. Rehearsing what you're going to say, actually have the words come out. There's a lot of misconception, with presenters. Well, first of all, with presenters, they have a high level of awareness that they're convinced that they're good or great presenters. I don't know where this comes from.
Well, okay? People are born that way, aren't they?
As I joke with participants, I say to them, if you had to rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate yourself as a presenter? And often, particularly in the sales marketing area, they will often say 8, 9. I've been a 10 before. And I go, that's astounding. How do you do that? That must have taken years of formal training. You must work one-on-one with a personal coach. And they pause and go, no, none of that. And that's when I zing them. I get it. I forgot that professionals are convinced that they're gifted. in presentation.
That's right. They are gifted.
And they're gifted. Okay? So it's an awareness thing, and that's one of the obstacles I deal with particularly senior individuals who may have been delivering presentations for years and years and years, and they look at someone like me or my organization and say, gosh, I've been doing this for 20 years. What is this individual going to do to help me? So it's a self-awareness issue.
Is it also a question of unlearning and then relearning? I mean, people who've been doing this, especially senior folks, they've got habits and style all of their own. I mean, do they have to unlearn in order to do stuff properly?
There is a very dramatic unlearning curve, because now rehearsal or presentation, much of this is a learned behavior. So now let's say they've spent 20 years. If they spent 25 years learning and they're reinforcing the same habit again and again and again and again. So it's painful for them in some cases to unlearn those things, because it's awkward. Now I'm asking them to do something else or to try different options, and they struggle with that.
Give me an example of one of your clients. You don't have to name them.
Oh, good.
But give us an example of a couple of these things from some of your clients.
One example, this is probably 4 or 5 years ago, and I was asked to come in with a very senior level team. It was a very high stakes presentation, very, very high stakes in terms of dollar value involved. And the senior team, I was brought in by a middle manager, as far as, okay, guys, we need to be able to, we need to be able to have some help in this presentation. The senior team, they were pushing back. They were just so anti, what am I going to do to help them? And in fact, I could feel it when I first went into the room and met them for the first time, and I could feel it in their handshakes. I could feel it in the handshakes. They're not with me. Okay, they don't believe in terms of what I may be able to offer. As it turned out, within 2 hours of the first session I spent with them, their eyes were open. They had no idea. Some of the techniques that I had introduced, they go, this is unbelievable. And the fun thing is, one of them said to me, we didn't know we were allowed to do that in presentations.
So give us some examples. What do you mean? What kind of techniques that can open the eyes of people to what this means?
Typically many presentations lack a strong opening. Or a clear opening. Many presentations open the same way. It's what I call drivel.
Here's the agenda. We'd like to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming.
Oh, and then it goes on. Gosh, I'm thrilled to be here. And let me tell you about the trip here. And let me tell you about... Get rid of it. That's drivel. Okay? Go right in. Make your point. Or as I work with individuals to make an impact, or develop what I call an impact statement. Arouse my curiosity. Provoke my thinking. Put me in a position as a listener to say, I'd like to hear more about that. Versus many introductions of presentations, a listener is frustrated and saying, okay, when are they going to get to, has it started yet? Is it, was that an important point? And, many presenters make it difficult for audience members to really understand what they're trying to say.
So an impact statement, getting right to the point, those are things that a lot of people don't do. How about starting with a story? That's often very effective. Not a pointless story, but something that illustrates a key issue.
And there are several techniques. It can be a story. It could be starting with a date. It could be starting with a visual picture you want to paint. Anything to what I call, rather than trying to break convention, but make convention. So you're making your own convention. You as a presenter should be the same individual before the presentation started as when the presentation is being delivered. I don't know about you. Have you ever noticed this? Have you ever gone into a room and you've met someone who's going to make a presentation and they're having a conversation and you're exchanging social? Well, it's people being people. Then all of a sudden something changes with that individual when they're about to make the presentation.
And they take a presentation pill. They become a different person.
It's what I... Yes, thank you. It's what I call the presentation chameleon. The presenter may just say this, as far as I'm concerned. Excuse me. You'll have to excuse me. I'm about to deliver a presentation. So that means I'm going to turn into someone you'll barely recognize for about the next 20 or 30 minutes. However, once I'm through, I'll be right back to who I was when we first met. That's the issue I have.
So that's an issue of authenticity, of integrity. Mm-hmm. How do you avoid going into this other mode? We see this when people do job interviews as well.
Very
we
much
see
so.
This often.
Very much so.
How do you avoid that?
Rehearse. And I'm not saying beat something to death. I'm not saying learn something, memorize it. What it is to learn a behavior that may not be that common for an individual. An individual may not deliver 8 presentations a day like I used to. An individual may deliver a presentation in front of their peers, let's say, 4 times a year. So that would be considered unconventional behavior for them, because they've been conditioned now, sitting around a table, one-on-one, 4 people in a meeting room. Now, all of a sudden, I'm at the front of the room, I have some technology I have to deal with, I have all these things, and that's when it becomes awkward, because they haven't started to learn it. We see learned behavior techniques in so many occupations. Think of law enforcement, emergency medical personnel, commercial airline pilots, simulated training to learn a response. So it becomes second nature. And that's the missing link in terms of presenters, because presenters, I made light of the fact that they consider themselves gifted, and yet they don't do anything with what they think their gift is as far as trying to rehearse or make it precise or find out what's going to come out of you when you actually stand in front of the room.
Now, some of our viewers may be doubting Thomas's. They may say, well, gee, Richard, you may be right, but thank you very much. If I rehearse, if I memorize my presentation, what you're doing is exactly, what exactly comes out is the opposite. I'll sound rehearsed. I'll sound like I'm, just like a tape recorder playing back what I rehearsed. I mean, what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would do is I would really define clearly to an individual what I consider what my philosophy on rehearsal is. Rehearsal isn't memorizing exactly word for word for word as a script. If I have to rehearse something, then all I have to do is, if I went through it one time, I'd find out what words actually came out of me. That's rehearsal. Looking at notes, thinking, this is what I'll say, is not rehearsal, and that's where they get into trouble.
Wonderful. Richard Peterson. We are talking to Richard Peterson on Professionally Speaking TV. We'll be back in a few more minutes. We'll learn a little bit more about how to rehearse and where that fits into the whole presentation mix. Come back. We'll be back in a second. We're back on Professionally Speaking TV on thatchannel.com. I'm your host, Randall Craig. We're interviewing Richard Peterson, who's a certified sales professional and an excellent, excellent rehearsal guru. And that's what we're going to talk about now. Before the break, you're talking about just getting comfortable with the words in your mouth. But is there any specific type of rehearsal? I've got my script right in front of me right here. Obviously, I don't want to memorize it. Or do I want to memorize it?
Well, there are 2 sections I would memorize. I mentioned earlier about the impact statement, and this may be 1 or 2 sentences.
This is right at the very beginning.
Right at the very first words that come out of your mouth, and I want to say the impact statement, the very first words that come out of your mouth aren't good morning and welcome and I'm so-and-so. You can roll that in. You make your impact statement first. I would really have that clear in your mind, because the audience will remember, typically, and there's lots of research that supports this, they'll remember the first words and the last words. So there should be continuity between your first words and the last words.
So memorize them.
Memorize them so they're cold. And I have several, what I call impact statements, or I have several variations of openers that I develop. And I may even change how I open a presentation based on how I feel that dynamic in that room, that I may use this technique or I may use that technique. Now, the rehearsal part, to go back to your question, many individuals, many professionals that I work with, the first words that come out of the mouth when I say rehearsal, I say, gosh, rehearsal, I don't have time to develop the presentation, much less rehearse it. So I have fun with them and I say, well, gosh, if you don't take the time to rehearse, you may want to consider that at some point, based on the quality of the presentations, you may have all kinds of time to rehearse as you're sitting at home alone in your bathrobe unemployed. So I use that as a context. I don't underestimate that for a second. There are shortcuts to rehearsal. My goal, first of all, is to be able to at least go through the entire presentation if I can once. Now, that isn't possible every time. All I have to do is find out, first of all, let me pick a section. Let me see how long that section took, and then do some quick math, and then I realize, gosh, if I'm using PowerPoint and I have this many pages of script, if I did the quick math and realized that, that took that much time, I realize now my presentation could take up to a week, I've got some work to do.
Mm-hmm.
Many individuals, through lack of rehearsal, have no idea how long their presentation is. That's number one issue. How many times have you seen a presentation whereby The presenter starts, and they seem to have all the time in the world in the beginning.
And at the very end, they really have to fit everything in very quickly.
And there's a panic. And it frustrates me to no end when I see, especially if it's driven or if it's supported with PowerPoint, and they start to race through the slides as if they're a gunfighter with their remote, flick, 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 and it almost becomes like a motion picture. And you can see the audience going, So now I've done, as a presenter, I've done a disservice to the audience. I've actually cheated them out of information because of my inability to have a handle on how long my presentation would take, what area needs work in it.
So number one is timing. Number one is timing. What's number two?
Number two would have a clear, clear solution to what is really the single main point of your presentation.
But is this rehearsal really?
Well, it can be. Okay, first of all, once the point is clear, then you know what to rehearse. Because, many presenters fall into the trap of, all right, I have to deliver a presentation on this topic. And, speaking of the workplace in this case.
Yes.
And they think, well, I have to talk about this. And if I talk about that, then I have to introduce this. And then once I introduce that, then I'll have to go over here. And they've lost the ability to answer the question that I challenge them with all the time. I said, okay, what is the single main point of your presentation? And they say, well, I'll be talking about this. No. What is the single main point? And that's where they struggle. So if we make that clear, then the presentation development becomes easy. It becomes simple, rather than trying to take information and work backwards. Now, once I have that structure, then I have to find out, by saying it out loud or portions of it out loud or time segments of it out loud, to really find out what words come out. And I don't underestimate that when I say to individuals, have you ever been in a meeting or a presentation and words start to come out of you, you just can't believe where they're coming from, but you can't stop them? So technically what you're doing is you're rehearsing now in front of the audience. I'd rather do it in a safe room, in a safe rehearsal setting when there isn't anybody around.
Now, a lot of people have a printout of a PowerPoint deck. And they say, okay, here's my presentation. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to read through. Okay, just read through. And they do it in their mind. And they're looking with their eyes. Is that adequate rehearsal? Obviously, I think your answer is going to be no. But must you always
really?
Do it? I'm putting words in your mouth here. Can you do it in your head? Is rehearsal in your head adequate?
Rehearsal in your head is, I call, wishful thinking. The ultimate optimist. I see this often. I travel by air, and I giggle when I see individuals in seats around me frantically working on their laptops, and I can see they're moving around slides and things like that. And all I can think of is, okay, so you have a presentation in the morning, and your biggest challenge would be that you hope the slides are in the right order, much less knowing what you'll say to open, much less knowing what you'll say, what anecdote, what story, what support, what evidence, what techniques you'll use. You're just hoping that you're not surprised by what slide that comes up, and you're not catching yourself saying, oh, I left that one in, if that helps.
Very interesting. Now, I read in one of your articles, you divide the actual presentation development into three: discovery, rehearsal, and forensic review. We've been talking about rehearsal. What's discovery all about?
Discovery is what research I have to do up front to be able to determine what's going to be relevant, what's going to be the hard-hitting topical content. If it's in a selling environment, that would be a discovery meeting that you would have with a potential prospect or existing client or customer. If you're speaking at a conference, that means you need to do some research as to who's going to be there, what is the industry, what is the gender skew, who am I talking to, what is the the age demographic, all of those things. Because until I know those things, I really don't know what to say. Because once I understand what the context is, then I can start to make my presentation. That's the discovery. And many individuals, I'm a professional both in business sales or whatever happens to be a technical industry, they fail to do much discovery or any discovery at all.
So is there a rule of thumb? If you've got a one-hour presentation, a 20-minute sales presentation, mm-hmm. is it 1 hour for every minute or is it 1 hour for 1 hour? What's the ratio of preparation, discovery, for the presentation?
I have seen contradicting research, and I've looked at it, and there isn't any, and I haven't discovered any clear rule. Basically, I would look, if I'm making a 20-minute presentation, I will probably put in 4 to 6 times that amount of time in terms of front-end research. Front-end, now research could, will also involve, the preparation of it, some rehearsal as well. Now that's if it's new content. If it's existing content, if I go back to when I would deliver 8 presentations a day, well, it'd be the same presentation, but the audience would shift a bit. So I would have different variations that I may have to be able to shift into, and that's the part that'll take the time. Now, if it's existing, much of it is ingrained; it's already second nature. And as you're doing that, then you're constantly testing your material to see if you're getting the response that you're really getting. Versus, is it just a part that you like to talk about because it feels good?
Okay, so you're a sales exec; you're selling a particular product or service. Mm-hmm. You've got your standard boilerplate presentation. You've done, for the 20-minute presentation, you've done your 3 hours of discovery.
Okay.
How much customization should you really do?
First of all, let me go back to boilerplate. I cringe when I hear boilerplate, or I cringe when I hear standard presentation or stock presentation, as I often hear from my clients that are involved in sales, and they will say, I'll send you our stock presentation. I said, oh, God, I'd like to see that because, I don't know about you, but I don't have any stock clients or stock customers. So I'd love to see how you do it this way. And they always, giggle and grin over that. And so they, what they realize is they fall into a trap of comfort that they have this information that they've decided is relevant to the environment, to the prospect, to the customer, because that's what they do. And that's where the salesperson, or even the business person in whatever technical field, falls into the trap, because they apparently, how is it that, some professionals think that they're smarter than their own clients or prospects because they know what they want to hear.
Well, let me turn this around a little bit. It struck me as you're saying that we may have to do discovery on our prospects, on our customers. But they also do some discovery on us as well, don't they?
Oh, very much so.
And part of that due diligence is looking at the presentations that we post effectively. We call them websites.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that can't be, that's a stock presentation without the verbal cue, isn't it? So how do we deal with the issue of customers looking at some of our brochures or our websites or stuff that's really generic? When, on the other hand, we want to be so specific when we're actually at their place of business.
And if I go back to stock presentation, I agree, the website or print material, whatever we use, that can be, that can be considered a stock presentation. The issue is many individuals fall into the trap of the stock presentation doesn't have any particular customer focus to it or client focus to it, and it tends to be inwardly focused.
Yes.
If I look at many materials and if I've listened to other presentations or websites, everything is about the supplier. Everything is about the provider. We are wonderful. We have this many offices, or we've done this. And however, it's not clear to me. It's okay. Well, the context, the benefit, we talk about benefit all the time. But the benefit is only an advantage generically to anyone who has a pulse or can breathe. It only becomes a benefit when it's relative to the context when you've developed it and delivered it to them. And they say, I get that. They're speaking to me. I love it when they're put in a position and say, I think they get me. I think they get us. We can work with that individual.
Okay. Discovery, rehearsal, forensic review. That's a term that I don't think people often hear when it comes to presentations. What does it mean?
Forensic review, my favorite, forensic review. Many individuals, after delivering a presentation, and I can look at any context. I could look at a keynote speech. I could look at a sales presentation, whatever it happens to be. There is very little or none as far as evaluation or analysis of, so what happened in that presentation? Then I can go back and document, say, gosh, they do it in sports all the time, analyze sports plays. Individuals who are avid golfers will agonize over videotape of their golf swing.
But it's embarrassing. If you blow the presentation, why would you want to, pick at that scab? I mean, a lot of people don't do it because of that reason, presumably.
Well, if I blow the presentation, and I don't want to talk about it, and I want to put it behind me. All I'm going to do is reinforce that same behavior
and
in the next
it.
Presentation. And I go, blew that one too. Blew that one too. I wonder why. That's the issue. It was fascinating to me in my workplace years, in the corporate years, how we would, a team of us would go in, major client, high stakes, team of us would go in, and you know, we would deliver our presentation, and our analysis, or as I call it, forensic review, consisted of one of two things. We'd gather outside in the parking lot next to our cars after the presentation, and we'd either smile at each other and say, that went well, or we'd wring our hands and look down at the pavement and say, that didn't go very well. And that was it.
And you can't really learn much from that kind of exchange, can you?
So there were times in my corporate career I was criticized because I would take my team, what for the rest of the day or the next day, we'd lock ourselves into a room after high-stakes presentations, let's take it apart. Let's find out what really worked. Let's find out what hit the marks, and let's find out how we got into trouble. Let's find out how the listener or prospect or a customer tuned out. Let's find out, and let's start to get these presentations now strategic, more strategic, rather than just being information that we feel good about saying. It's that simple.
Very good. Very good. So, discovery, rehearsal, forensic review. One of the questions, one of the things that you talk about is preparedness.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you mean by that? That sounds like rehearsal, but is it different?
Well, preparedness, many individuals who go into a presentation environment fall into what I call a false sense of preparedness. This goes back to the individual who may look over a series of notes and say, yeah, I'm ready. I'm clear. Or they fall into the trap, and sometimes I'll catch myself doing this too. It's like, I just delivered this 2 days ago. I don't have to prep. I don't have to rehearse this one more time. This is what I do, and that's a trap. That's what I call a false sense of preparedness. So preparedness, taking all of those elements and saying, okay, if you had to make a checklist, did you do your discovery? Did you rehearse? Have you checked your technology? Have you done all of these things, or are you going in to every presentation and crossing your fingers and hoping it works out okay? And I see individuals like that. So false sense of preparedness is what I would say in that case.
Very good. Now, earlier on, we were talking about PowerPoint, and you had said, well, it's sort of like a prop, and you have to use it for the best thing. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about other kinds of props. Mm-hmm. How do you use props in presentations? Not many people feel comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. Should they? How do you use props?
I encourage the use of anything that I would consider a prop. And a prop could be, whatever the visual aid happens to be. It could be your product. It could be a device. It could be a storyboard. It could be anything to reinforce. Because, I mean, the point of your presentation is to make it memorable. If you're delivering presentations in the workplace or in a selling environment, you're likely presenting to individuals who that's not the first presentation they've seen this week. That's not the first presentation they've seen today. They have witnessed a sea of presentations. How will yours stand out, or how will yours become more memorable? You have to introduce some techniques. Otherwise, you're the same person that said, oh, good morning, it's great to be here, and then the end, and that's it. So, the use of props. There was a client I worked with a few years ago, and this was a fine paper client, heavy in the graphics industry. And this individual, I spoke to him on how to handle their own presentation materials. They had printed, they were actually presenting paper samples. And I said, well, what you have to do is you have to handle it in such a way as you elevate the value that it's no longer a piece of paper. This is something that people are craving for. And this individual, he was classic. He took this very seriously, and it was a 2-day program, and he found a way to get some white cotton gloves. And during his presentation, he then wrapped this paper, unwrapped it carefully, donned these white cotton gloves, and handled it as if it was precious cargo. And this individual contacted me a couple of years later, and he told me he had exceeded his targets the second year by 192%.
The white cotton gloves did the trick.
Well, and there's an example of props. However, Many times, I mentioned there may be some anxiety about, gosh, you know, do I use a prop? Well, what will matter if you try it and it doesn't work? Okay.
Yeah, what's the worst that can happen?
Try something else. And that's what influenced my selling career. My time, I had very little sales training. My sales training was traveling with a senior rep for half a day. At the end of the afternoon, I was handed a book and a set of car keys and saying, good luck, young man. And that was the extent of it. So I had to learn. I said, And a lot of it becomes human behavior. Human behavior in presenting. We talk about authenticity, be yourself. And I often, smirk when an individual says, "Well, how do you be yourself?" It's actually quite simple. Avoid the temptation of being someone else. You just have to avoid the temptation of copying or trying to emulate. You know, well, emulate is one thing. Just, are you the same person if you were talking across the table to your best friend? Are you the same person when you stand in front of 10 people or 100 people in a group? Are you the same person, or have you become somebody else? So that's my advice to people like that.
Super advice. Now, you asked the question, you said that it's not bad to emulate other people, not copy them, obviously. Who are some of your early influences, certainly from the presentation, the world of making presentations?
I was often, even as a young man, I was often quite taken by watching strong political figures on television, and I was in awe of watching how an individual who could talk to such a mass of people and have such a strong influence through carefully chosen words, and it was through their delivery, their body movement, their gestures, their facial expressions, and I was quite taken by that. Without naming political figures, but I was quite taken by watching political figures, even as a teenager, as I was. Because I found that many individuals really didn't take seriously how powerful their words could be in terms of influence, persuasion, agreement.
Let me ask you, do you still watch them? Do you still gain inspiration by watching political figures make their presentations?
Well, of late there have been some fascinating political figures in terms of the way that, they presented themselves. And sometimes there's a bit of, a bit of artificialness is showing up now, and I can tell who has had extensive coaching, and that they're now going into a presenter mode, and they're suppressing their own personalities. That's what I find, in that case. But certainly, I find it's a little more manufactured than it used to be. If I use the example, and not to get too cerebral here, I was often fascinated by a 260-word address made by Abraham Lincoln, the Gettysburg Address, 268 words, and the impact and the influence that those words had, versus they had orators who came on after Abraham Lincoln, who spoke for hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that told me, he said, okay, so choose your words carefully. We've heard that expression, choose your words carefully. And how is it that presenters, think of it as, all right, so volume of words. We talk about high-impact content. Well, many presenters confuse volume of information to content.
Wonderful. Richard, we're going to talk more about some of these problems that other executives and salespeople have just after the break. You're watching Professionally Speaking TV. I'm Randall Craig on thatchannel.com. Back in a second. We're back on thatchannel.com. This is Professionally Speaking TV. I'm Randall Craig, your host, continuing the discussion with Richard Peterson. Now, most executives don't get it right the first time. What are some of the most common problems that either executives or salespeople face when they're actually doing their presentation? What are some of the tactical things?
Okay, when you say tactical, let me break it into two groups. Business executives typically fall into the trap of they want to tell everything that is in their head that they have contained in their head for the last 20 years, and they want to cram it into a 25-minute presentation to their employees or whatever. And the technique I use, that I say to them is, okay, well, when you're delivering a presentation, tell them what they need to know, not everything you know. Okay? And that's going to help them focus them down. sales individuals or sales professionals will follow a similar tact, however they get their audience or they get the position of the presentation a bit wrong, because they spend more time talking about themselves, their product, their service, their company, versus how those things will then help the customer or prospect's world spin faster. And that's where they fall into that trap. And I go back to, you know, something I said earlier in the interview about advantage versus benefit. And advantage is something that is just generic. This is what my product, service, or my organization does for anyone. That's the advantage. The benefit is when I take that and tailor and craft my words precisely through discovery, and now I can point in like a laser to how that will now affect or help or make the world spin faster for that customer. That's the only time it's a benefit.
Hey, what other kind of problems? How about nerves? A lot of people are nervous doing speaking in front of a group, whether it be a sales presentation or an executive in front of their employees.
Anxiety is very common. Anxiety is common. It's something that's been well documented, whereby individuals, particularly if they're making a presentation and it's outside of their normal or their conventional way of presenting. Presenting could be one-on-one, four people around a room. Now, if it's different and I have to present as a single person to a group, I feel centered out, and it's actually been researched. It's called the spotlight effect. And many of those things, it becomes emotional. It becomes the fear of failure, fear of rejection, all of those things. And they're all common and normal. And there is a, I go back to rehearsal, there's a direct relationship in terms of how serious and how much time you spend in rehearsal to your level of anxiety. Little or no rehearsal, high anxiety. Positive rehearsal, low anxiety, because now I've conditioned myself, so I'll now learn how my body, mind, and voice will respond in that environment.
Like the Olympic athlete training to win the race.
Well, I mean, and that's, I often talk about sports figures, because just imagine, okay, so I'm an athlete and the Olympics are, you know, 4 years away or whatever it's going to be. Now, am I going to wait and see it's 6 weeks before the Olympics, since, you know, I'm a runner, and say, gosh, I wonder why I've left my shoes. You know, I should start training on this. And now it's like 2 days away. Well, I found the one shoe and I'm still looking for the other shoe. No, they're constantly evolved, constantly training. Many individuals as professionals go from what I call hot and cold. They'll cramp, you know, typically like a, you know, like a college student, will cram for the exam, whew, got that presentation, complete. I don't have to think about it now till the next one, which is 2 months from now, whatever. And I recommend to many individuals to spend, I mean, what if you spend 15 minutes a week, even, in terms of looking at previous presentations, how you could develop impact statements, how you could develop, what are some stories or analogies or anecdotes, or what are some topical facts you could add to it? Well, you know, like what if you spend 15 minutes a week on that? So that way you're keeping your presentation
fresh.
Presence fresh. Because presentation skills, if you want to call it, will erode like anything else. I mean, like any technique, sport, typical training. I could attend training, and 6 months later, if I haven't applied it, I've probably forgotten most of it because I haven't conditioned, I haven't tuned myself. So I need to tune myself on a regular basis. And presenters rarely tune themselves because they're gifted, apparently.
Very, very interesting. Now, one of the other problems that people have is to insert certain words in their presentation. I've heard too many presentations where they say or right or you know or mm-hmm. whatever it happens to mm-hmm. be. How do you solve that? Is that also rehearsal? I mean, it might be more than that, I think.
Occasionally, I will have an individual who that it becomes a speech habit, and it's difficult, you know, it's difficult for them to work with it because they're not even aware they're using it. Much of it is awareness. I have a coach, I bounce off some of my material off because I need to recognize what I consider many of us have a repetitive phrase or a favorite expression or
yes.
whatever, and we'll just use it and use it and use it and use it. And we're not aware of it. And then if I listen to, I mean, if I'm rehearsing, I will either videotape or I'll audio tape sections of words I'll say, and I go, gosh, I'm saying that a lot. There was an expression I picked up over a year ago, and I don't know where this came from, but every time I went to make a point, and I said, well, Well, the fact of the matter is, and it was driving me crazy when I listened to it, and once I heard it, now my awareness went up so that I could catch myself when I heard myself say it. Now, that's a favorite expression of repetitive phrases. If I go to the ums and ahs, which is common, the ums and ahs is where I'm reaching for the next words to say. In conversation, we very seldom use what I call a non-word, like ah, or whatever, because I'm not thinking typically of what am I going to say next, because I'm trying to remember, what's on the PowerPoint slide, what's in the script, what... It's conversation.
It's so organic.
And it becomes second nature. So the and ah really comes out of knowing the content, knowing the material, and being able to deliver it conversationally rather than, you know, trying to work from a script or, you know, trying to memorize it in that case. So two different things, but same diagnosis in both cases.
Okay. I do have another question. Yeah. This has to do with the great old debate. During a presentation, should you take questions at the end or should you take questions during the presentation itself?
Well, two things. How to take those questions is one thing. And my feeling on where to take those questions, my strong position is, as a presenter, I should have the last word. As the presenter, I will then deliver my closing remark or my closing argument or whatever it happens to be to really reinforce the point of my presentation. If I introduce a question opportunity at the end, I may be taking a risk. There could be someone sitting in the audience with their arms crossed, sitting there
waiting
to throw what I call the flaming arrow. They're just waiting. And that could then start to discredit. It could start to pull down the impact of the whole presentation because now it's blown up into a debate. I would rather, if I'm going to have something that heats up, I'd rather solve it and whatever techniques I'd use to diffuse it, then I would make my closing remarks. So I support doing that at the end rather than, and I've seen this...
Doing the questions within, you mean, not
within,
at the end.
Within segments, and certainly before, and the technique I would often use is, before I make my closing remarks, I've covered two topic areas, topic A, topic B. Would it be helpful to anyone in the audience to spend more time while clarifying anything in topic A, topic B? Now, you notice the technique, I didn't say, are there any questions? I encourage...
You focus them.
I encourage individuals to try to avoid using that in their vocabulary, because here's what happens. If I ask you, if you've listened to me for 30 minutes, and if I ask you, are there any questions? Your mind may be back 10 minutes earlier. Mine may be back at a concept I delivered earlier. And it's almost jarring or abrasive to snap me back into, okay, at this second? No, I don't have any questions at this second. And I have found that has, has been a deafening silence in many cases when someone says, are there any questions?
Which is something you might want. Okay, in our last minute, you've done all the preparation, you've done the rehearsal, you've done forensic reviews for years. All of a sudden you get up and something goes wrong, really wrong. What should you do?
Mm-hmm. And I've had that happen. And
I think everybody has. Everybody has. What do you do? The 30-second answer. Run.
hope there's a trap door that you can pull a lever with. Now, all right, what I would do is, first of all, if you have done all of those things you had just mentioned, now you are in a state of readiness. Your first reaction is, have you prepared for the worst? That's part of your readiness. Then all I have to do is what I call minimize the event. I can't let myself shatter. I'm a professional. I prepared. I've anticipated things going wrong, and I have contingencies that I can follow so that it becomes minimal and sure, or it may be something that may be humorous that I could have fun with and it adds to the presentation, or I basically just keep going.
And did that advice work for you when it went wrong for you?
Many times it did, not always. Many times it did, but not always.
Wonderful, wonderful. Richard, thank you very much for coming in to Professionally Speaking TV. If our viewers want to learn more, they can go to your website, which is www.presentationinstitute.com. www.presentationinstitute.com and see all the good stuff that you've got there. And thank you for coming to Professionally Speaking TV on thatchannel.com. Another week of great insight this time on presentations from Richard Peterson. If you want to see our upcoming schedule, go to www.professionallyspeakingtv.com. My name is Randall Craig. If you want to have an impact first, you have to do it professionally. See you next week.